But it gives me great pleasure also to thank all of the organizations that have been responsible for bringing this wonderful group of people together. And I hope that the hour and a half we have will provide us with an opportunity to really begin thinking creatively around what role each individual one of us can play in relation to the global challenges that we're all confronting. I can't recall a time in my life when things have seemed so bleak and challenging. Nor can I remember a time in my life when everybody feels kind of paralyzed by the magnitude of the challenges that we're facing. So I'm hoping that this can be the beginning, at least, of some introduction to the ways in which we can begin engaging the challenges, doing what we can from where we are, but by mobilizing people in order to kind of think about and do and work for a better world. So do you want to make any opening comments as well, then?
Well, thank you, Ingrid. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm sorry we feel a little bit low here, so I hope everyone's got some line of sight. I've known Kevin probably for around half a century. He was a colleague of my husband's in the sociology department at Canterbury University in the 1970s. I was just reflecting, Kevin, on what you said about this being the bleakest time you can remember. And, I mean, it's not great. But then, you know, the 70s and 80s weren't great either. That's you know, true. If you think of the whole nuclear standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States, those were grim times. So, you know, I think we just need a bit of perspective that the world has been in very bleak spots, but it's come out of them. The problem is we never learn the lessons of history. We keep going back into them. And, you know, and, yeah, they each have their own characteristics. But it's challenging, but we should talk about the ways forward.
Yeah. I was also told by an old friend of mine, Stella Cornelius, that you should never start with the negative. You should always start with the positive. And so it's very hard at this moment to sort of start with the positive. But, you know, we know that the world's confronted with multiple violent conflicts in Ukraine, Sudan, and the Middle East being the most bloody and graphic. There are escalating geopolitical tensions, rising inequality, stalled progress on the social development goals, and a climate emergency. So the first kind of question I really want to put on the table, Helen, is, you know, what gives you hope in relation to all of these diverse challenges? And can you identify individuals and groups who are really beginning to tackle them in a productive and positive way? Because, you know, it seems to me that we can easily surround ourselves with gloom, but we need to start focusing on some of the hopeful signs as well.
So we're living in the, you know, the poly-crisis, as the term goes, and while, you know, the focus today is on peace, and that makes us think of the many conflicts, there is, in essence, what we dubbed at the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health, which I chair, the three C's crisis. We call it COVID, climate, conflict, all intersecting, you know, cascading effects across these crises. I mean, don't underestimate what the pandemic did to the finances of every country on earth, including our own. But if you're a low-income country with very limited fiscal space, it's been pretty dire. Add to that the, you know, growing impacts of the climate crisis and the ever more frequent climate events, which are very severe, which Dunedin's obviously experiencing as we speak, and my city, Auckland, did early last year, and the Hawke's Bay and the East Coast and Coromandel currently. You know, this is costing countries big time as well. And then you have the conflicts, and there's not only the, you know, the most obvious impacts of the conflict, which is death, injury, displacement. You know, 1% plus of the world's population is forcibly displaced at the moment. That's a horrific number of people. But then there's all the spillover impacts that ripple all the way down to us, like the cost of living crisis, the, you know, the erratic fuel and food commodity prices, and so on. So it's a poly crisis. So what gives you hope? Well, firstly, the fact that a room like this fills today with people who are interested in, you know, being part of a dialogue about what can be done. And secondly, I think, you know, the strength of civil society around the world, and we must really fight for space for civil society, which is under severe constraint in many countries. But from that community level up, you know, there's a desire to build something better. And having, you know, operated in New York at the UN Development Programme, you became so conscious that people aren't sitting waiting, you know, for wealthy countries to come and dump money on them and, quote, do things for them. No, people want to chart their own destiny, and we must support those, you know, from the community and local level up who are trying to make a difference for the better.
Yeah. And one of the other things which in peace research we focus attention on is the kind of, who are the connectors in our communities? That is, who are the people that are bringing us together rather than those who are dividing us? And one of the other kind of elements of the crisis that we're currently confronting is that the dividers seem to be in the ascendancy at the moment. And we've got these hugely polarized societies all around the world. And we'll get on to what that means in terms of challenges to democracy a little later on. One of the hopeful signs, though, Helen, is that is the elders that you're a part of. You're a member of the elders. Can you give us a little bit of insight into how they work and how for peace, justice, human rights, and a sustainable planet, and how effective do you think they are in relation to providing some alternative perspectives on the problems that are confronting us?
Well, when Mary Robinson, the former Irish president and well-known in New Zealand, approached me in June last year and said, the elders would like you to join them. Of course, my first answer was, I'm too young. but I did find there's younger than I am in Zaid Al-Hussein, the former UN Human Rights Commissioner, who's terrific. So, of course, I was honoured to be asked. I mean, this is a group that began under the patronage of Nelson Mandela. And it was actually an idea of Richard Branson's. You know, Richard Branson is an amazing human being, obviously done very well in business, very entrepreneurial. But he's a guy who, from his teenage years, was out, you know, protesting against apartheid and the Vietnam War and the rest of it. And he's really very committed to many of the things which people in this room would be very supportive of. So Richard Branson went to Nelson Mandela and he said, I've got this idea that we need a network of very senior leaders who could exercise soft power, and I'd like you to lead it. And Nelson Mandela said to him, Richard, I'm too old to lead it, I'll be the patron, but I will offer you my wife and the Archbishop. So Archbishop Tutu chaired it for some years, as did Kofi Annan, and Graça Machel, Nelson Mandela's widow, is still on it today, and also the widow of the first president of Free Mozambique. So that's how it began. And if I fast forward to today, they keep the numbers at around 12. It has a small family of supporters, of foundations, high net worth people like Richard, obviously, who are considered part of their family because they support it because they believe in the kind of role that the elders can play. And I mean, it's interesting to me that, you know, the elders are rung and asked to brief the Security Council. I was in the Security Council two Thursdays ago, making a statement on behalf of the elders on Israel-Palestine, which we can talk a little bit more about. But we were asked by the presiding country, Slovenia, because they said, you will come and speak truth to power as the elders. Mm-hmm. You have a perspective on how this dispute could be resolved, or at least a process. You know, come and say some things, which I did. Of course, the elders being interested in Israel-Palestine doesn't arise in a vacuum either, because Nelson Mandela had a special place in his heart for Palestinians. Mm-hmm. You know, he led a country out of, you know, a very difficult situation. And if you go to Ramallah in Palestine, you will see a huge statue of Nelson Mandela with a quote of what he said about the Palestinian people. So that's been on the agenda, you know, since 2007 when the group began. They have four areas of focus. One of them is conflicts, and as we know, there are many conflicts around the world, so don't try and focus on all of them. There's a focus on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, on Israel-Palestine, and also on Myanmar, probably because Ban Ki-moon, who became an elder before I did, had a particular interest, and I keep particular interest in the Myanmar conflict as well. A second area of focus is nuclear disarmament, because somebody has to keep focusing on it. You know, it keeps slipping down the radar, and yet it is an existential threat of nuclear war. Thirdly, of course, the climate change issues, which Mary Robinson has really dedicated a lot of her life to in recent years, to climate justice. And then fourthly, they've had a health theme for a number of years. It was universal health coverage, and then with the pandemic, they morphed to become very focused on the pandemic issues. So there's none of these four areas that I'm not, you know, deeply interested in myself, so it's a kind of natural fit for me to be associated with the group.
Thank you. And we've all been shocked by what's been happening in the Middle East over the past week, a few weeks, and indeed over the past probably, you know, 50-odd years. And the submission you made to the Security Council on the 19th of September was on Palestine, and that was before the invasion of Lebanon and Hezbollah, Syria and Iran, and now there's even discussions between America and Israel about, you know, what they can and cannot attack in Iran. So can you give us some idea about what the elders were proposing in relation to the Middle East? Because I think the principles you enunciated were really interesting, especially in relation to the Security Council resolution 2334 and then 2735.
So the statement that I gave, which was carefully crafted, as you can imagine, with the support of our secretariat, first was an appeal to the Security Council to uphold its own resolutions, which it's notoriously bad at. And there was a resolution 2334 of December 2016, right at the end of the Obama presidency, where the US for the first time abstained on a resolution which addressed the issue of the illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. That has never been upheld, action following from that. And secondly, we drew attention to 2735, which was passed in June this year, which called for the full, immediate, complete ceasefire in order to lead to hostage release, prisoner exchange, and the, you know, beginning of a process towards peace. That's been more honored in the breach than the observance as well. The second key point was that the Security Council members, as well as the member states of the UN, should be upholding the determinations and processes of the international judicial institutions. The International Court of Justice, which brought down the decision with the provisional measures with respect to protection of civilians in Gaza and warning of stopping steps which would amount to genocide. And secondly, its advisory opinion on the illegality of the occupation of the Palestinian territory. And then the International Court of Justice, where the prosecutor has asked for support from the International Criminal Court to prosecute named individuals from Hamas and Israel with respect to war crimes. Now, both international courts have come under attack. And I think what we observe is a bit of, you know, a la carte respect for courts. You know, one side will be all for it when it brings down an indictment against President Putin, but all against it when it brings down an indictment against others they support, and vice versa. So it's the a la carte support reflecting the polarized geopolitics, which is, you know, very paralyzing of the Security Council. So those were the principles around which this was framed.
Good. What do you think of the kind of medium and long-term prospects for peace in the Middle East? Because this is something I think which sort of sits on us like an incubus and has done so for the last, you know, 50-odd years. What do you see as sort of the bright spots and real leverage points?
Well, you know, sometimes in the bleakest times, something can happen. If you think back to the end of the Vietnam War, there was incredibly heavy bombing before that ever got to a peace process. And a lot of people were killed, a lot of people being killed and maimed and displaced now. But I think any talk of resolution or moving forward is on hold, pending what happens in the US elections. Because let's face it, You know, the UN has been kept well away from the Israel-Palestine issues for a long time. The US has pretty much kept that, you know, to itself and its discussions with Israel and its discussions with the Arab states. And we don't know, who will be US president, and B, whether it will matter a lot who it is anyway. I mean, that's the sad thing. You know, if it goes on as business as usual, then we're in for a lot more agony. But we may not be. And, you know, on the one hand, you have President Trump, who does say it should end, but how he wants it to end is another matter. He clearly keeps close to the Saudis. The Saudis, interestingly, are playing very hard to get on the Abrahamic Accord and signing up, you know, to diplomatic relations with Israel. They did their foreign minister, Prince Faisal, did a press conference last week in New York with the Norwegian foreign minister, and he said that, you know, the Saudis are hanging out for a process for a Palestinian state. They're very clear on that. So let's hope that stays clear, because it is key to a resolution that is a decent one. So who knows where President Trump might enter into this conversation? He also doesn't particularly seem to like spending a lot of money on allies. So again, you know, maybe Israel shouldn't expect the checkbook to be wide open without some conditionality. Who knows? And then you have Kamala Harris, who, when I was in New York, the talk was that her team is disconcerted by the approach the administration's taking, but nothing will be said, obviously, this side of an election, because anything you say about anything is weaponized. But will she bring in a different foreign policy team that says enough? I don't know. As I say, everything might change, nothing might change.
Good. In relation to the other war, which is worrying everybody in the Ukraine at the moment, I mean, New Zealand committed itself both to humanitarian assistance and military support. Do you think it would have been more prudent for New Zealand to have condemned the invasion and focused more on humanitarian assistance rather than got mired in the conflict itself?
Well, just before that, I mean, sort of coming off the first part of the question, the other conflict. There are so many other conflicts who get no attention, right? I was moved to tweet in the last couple of days again about Sudan, 100,000 dead and 20% of the population displaced. Is the world talking about Sudan, or is it just doesn't matter? I mean, this is shocking. And, you know, there are proxies behind the factions in that war. And some of them are allies of very powerful countries, but they're not called to heal either. I mean, this war wouldn't be sustained without people arming, both the Sudanese army and the paramilitary RSF. So, you know, shocking, shocking. But coming back to Ukraine, I remember having a conversation about this with Mary Robinson also some time ago with respect to the position of Ireland. And Ireland's position was full humanitarian support for Ukraine, but no weapons. Probably would have been the smarter thing for us.
Good, you've already mentioned the other forgotten wars in Sudan, and then there's renewed violence in the DRC as well, and an upsurge of fighting in Myanmar. I mean, one of the challenges, it seems, in relation to all of these conflicts is that no third-party governments, regional organizations, or the UN itself have been capable of preventing them or of bringing them to a close. The last successful UN negotiation, for example, was the Colombian peace agreement in 2016. So what do you think is behind all this? Is it the sort of the changing nature of armed conflict, or a real inability for governments as third parties, regional organizations, or the UN to grapple with them as they are emerging and as they become full-blown conflicts?
And, you know, to what extent was Colombia itself, quote, a success for the UN? I mean, the Colombia settlement came about because, to everyone's amazement, a man who had been a hardline security minister, Juan Manuel Santos, in President Uribe's government, turned around and put out an arm to say, I'm prepared to talk. And I once said to him, because I got to know him when I was at UNDP, and he sits on the elders with me today, I said to him, what explains what you did? Because you had a reputation for being a very hardline security minister. You know, you were after the FARC. You know, there are a lot of deaths. You're fully militarized. He said, look, he said, my story goes like this. He said, in the 90s, when I was a minister, I went to Geneva for a conference. And I heard Nelson Mandela talk about his life and what he'd done in South Africa. He said, and I sat there and I thought, if I ever had the chance to do that for my country, would I do it? He said, but I couldn't say anything because I would never have been elected president. When I was elected president, I thought, this is the opportunity I have. And it wasn't easy going. You might remember that initially when they negotiated a deal, they put it to a referendum and the public knocked it back with his old president, Uribe, in full cry against him. But I really credit Santos with the maturity and vision, and he got a Nobel Peace Prize for his pains with driving that through. I knew the UNDP rep, who was also UN resident coordinator at the time, very well, and he was a behind-the-scenes person as well. And I remember going to dinner with one of the ministers who was almost full-time on the case. And let's not overlook the role of the Cubans, who hosted the talks and kept the FARC there. The FARC sat in hotels in Cuba, in Havana, for probably a couple of years while this was done. They kept them on side. But the minister, who was pretty focused on it, started talking about the negotiations and where they were at, and he said to me, you know, he said that the most humiliating thing to me about it all, he said, is what they want is so little. We've been fighting a civil war for half a century over, in effect, land issues. He said, it's ridiculous, and it has to stop. So anyway, I mean, yes, the UN was helpful, but in the end, I think there were local actors that really, really drove this through. But anyway, as for the rest of it, if we've knocked that one out, how far back do we have to go? I think, you know, for quite a while now, the UN has often looked to the regional actors to try to lead on conflict resolution. But the regional actors are weak. So take ASEAN with Myanmar. Well, you know, ASEAN works by consensus, and the consensus may be quite a low-level denominator. And there are countries in ASEAN which aren't particularly prepared to call Myanmar out, because clearly ASEAN itself has a range of political systems. So that hasn't been easy. And while they had the five-point consensus, proved almost impossible to move forward on that. The UN has been very much a bit player. I think it's on its, you know, third special representative of the Secretary General to the conflict since the military coup. Now Julie Bishop, the former Australian Foreign Minister, who I saw in New York, and Julie's very energetic and she's moving around talking to a lot of people, yet to be received in Naypyidaw. But you know, I mean, the battlefield, as it were, is quite interesting, with the opposition making a lot of ground. But, you know, if you look at other conflicts, if the military get too much on the back foot, when do other actors come in with new technologies which enable the military to turn the tide again, as we saw with Tigray and northern Ethiopia or in any number of conflicts? So I think there's been an attitude among some in the resistance that now's not the time to talk because, you know, they may make more ground. I'm not so sure about that. I think that, you know, there could be a stepped up militarization of the conflict, and in a way it's never too early to talk if you're interested in saving lives and stopping people getting horribly maimed and so on. So anyway, not much happening on that score at the moment. The UN peacekeeping missions seem to pretty much run their course. We're far away from the heyday of the Brahimi Report and Kofi Annan's, you know, new agenda for peace and whatever. The mission was kicked out of Mali in the last year or so. It's been kicked out of Democratic Republic of Congo, of course, left Haiti. They're now trying to work out what they do again with Haiti, which seems to be ruled by criminal gangs more than anyone else. But it's not great. In West Africa, ECOWAS, the regional organization, did try to stand up to the series of military coups, but for its pains, the three countries who had coups left the organization, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. And their security is now provided by our old friends, the Wagner Group, alias Russian military. So, yeah, it's not good. And the UN is not seen as playing really a key role in resolving any of this.
Why do you think that's so? Why is the UN, which is tasked with the responsibility of maintaining international peace and security and generating positive peace and so forth, is so incapable at the moment and seems so paralyzed in so many different fronts? And Guterres makes the right comments, you know, and statements about things that are happening, but you know, he himself is now excluded from visiting Israel, the Middle East. By Netanyahu. So what is it about the UN which is, disabling it to do the things it was meant to do? And do you want to make brief comments about the summit for the future, which, you know, some people think might have provided an opportunity for thinking afresh about UN reforms? And yet, when you look at the action points in the Pact for the Future and so forth, and international security, they seem high on rhetoric and low on substance. Mm.
Well, you know, when the UN was founded, it was against, you know, it was sort of in the ashes of World War II, right? You've had the end of the war in Europe, the end of the war in Japan and the Pacific. And I think the vision was to stop another world war between great powers. And, you know, we could be Pollyanna and say, there hasn't been another war between great powers. However, we hover perilously close. But what it hasn't proved very adept at doing is dealing with different types of conflicts, the civil wars, the non-state actors. The whole peacekeeping architecture really isn't very well adapted to that. And there's been a lot of ideas about that. There's also the case that a lot of countries that are fragile and at risk of lapsing into further conflict are desperately poor. And it's hard to make, you know, a decent, honest living, which means that where you have well-financed non-state actors who are involved in, you know, smuggling, whether of people or contraband goods or arms or whatever, you can conscript young people to the task, and you've really got a lot of poverty and, you know, extreme underdevelopment driving these situations, and so often we sort of stretch for the, you know, the military toolkit rather than going back and saying, excuse me, what is the origin of this? What is driving this bubbling up and simmering conflict in countries? And it's hard really to get the support you need for the basic peace building work on the ground. You know, in the end, you know, the plate is put around, like at the end of the Sunday church service, for humanitarian relief, and that's never quite enough, but it comes to some degree. But investment in the basic, you know, precursors of peace, which is, you know, a sense that you have an opportunity, a stake in society, a livelihood, you can get your education, your kids can get their education, you've got healthcare, and so on. That the world's not so generous on these things. So we keep, you know, going on in this spiral. Now, on the pact for the future, again, you could be Pollyanna. And Pollyanna would say, it's a wide-ranging document that touches on all the important issues, and there's hooks on it, you know, like, you know, a Christmas tree where you can dress it up over time if you've got determined, you know, issue-based coalitions of states that are prepared to pick up things and run with them. I must say, if you read through the Pact for the Future, there's not a single binding action in it. And it has more than 50 actions, but there's no action. Right. Right? You read through it. You know, we will protect all civilians in armed conflict. Or could they start today? People in humanitarian environments will get the support they need today. I mean, you know, there's no money, there's no requirement, there's no mechanism. It's really quite sad. And, you know, I mean, obviously the Russians are getting a lot of blame for holding the thing up till the end, but, I mean, really, that's all a bit irrelevant. This is a weak document. I mean, it doesn't point to a review conference at the UN to deal with some of the issues. So, I mean, all I can say is there's never been a time with a greater need for small powers, medium powers coming together around the things that need to be done and trying to, you know, build up campaigns for these in the multilateral system, because otherwise the UN will continue to drift and drift.
Moving on to our own region in the Asia Pacific, you know, do you think that China and the US are engaged in a kind of a battle for primacy, and or is the Chinese response largely being reactive to the US desire to still be top dog? And in that context, I mean, China feels the West has abandoned preventive diplomacy and conflict prevention as stoking fear to justify coercive diplomacy and military containment. And then their argument about that is that it's all reflected in the Quad, the Indo-Pacific Four, which includes Australia, Japan, South Korea, and New Zealand, NATO's Asia expansion, and AUKUS. Can you tell us why you're opposed to these agreements, and what would you do about them if you're still Prime Minister?
Well, wouldn't be in them is a short answer. So, I mean, clearly the US has an interest in, you know, continuing to be what has been the sole superpower for quite a long time. And you know, that's kind of natural when you think about it, that they would want that. I think the insights we got from Professor Hugh White's visit a couple of months ago is that the US is not investing nearly enough to make that remotely a possibility in the West Pacific. And he contrasted the levels of military expenditure during the Cold War with what the US spends today. And his thesis was that while the goal may be to keep military primacy in the West Pacific, it can't do it. On the other hand, you have China, which is a rising power, fast rising power, and has its own ambitions. So somehow I think, you know, countries like New Zealand need to be thinking about how we position. I think Hugh White was right to say that it's more important than ever to have a good relationship with ASEAN as a bloc and look at how it navigates between blocs. I mean, we're in an interesting situation. We're probably the most, you know, the most isolated Western country geographically. It's quite clear where the value system of New Zealand is, but we also have, you know, to make a living, and like, you know, the majority of the world's countries, making a living has quite a dependence on China. There's nothing unique about that. So the last thing we need is outright conflict between the two of them, nor do we need the Western world decoupling its economy from China, which would be catastrophic for us, but it would be catastrophic for most countries, by the way. And you know, let's not think that, you know, decoupling Western economies from China is going to be a very successful enterprise, because the bulk of the world is not Western countries. Population is actually quite small. The dynamism is somewhere else. And you need to be positioned as a small trading economy to be able to, you know, to prosper geographically broadly. So I think there is some serious thinking to be done about the course New Zealand has pitched itself on at the moment, which I do not agree with. You know, when you see in official briefings, and I have seen one which is shortly to be released, New Zealand is, quote, in strategic alignment with the United States. I haven't seen that in a briefing paper in my time. I mean, we have differences. We also have some agreement. We've been able to work issue by issue, but, you know, the lineup of strategic alignment, invoking the ANZUS Treaty again, which we were thrown out of operation and involved with close to four decades ago, going from exploring the possibilities of AUKUS Pillar 2 to seeing good reason to engage with it, which was the Blinken-Peters statement of recent months. You now see New Zealand's sole Navy tanker acting as a force multiplier for the Royal Australian Navy, trundling through the Straits of Taiwan, hello. Presumably, and I don't know whether it's the only Royal New Zealand Navy participation in the West Philippine Sea exercise, but someone's there from the Navy. I mean, what are we trying to do here? It's beyond me. So I think our positioning is actually quite damaging to the independent stance that we've had. I mean, linking also back to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what on earth are we doing supporting the bombing of the Houthis in Yemeni? I've been to Yemen in my time at UNDP. The Houthis controlled the north of the country then. They now pretty much control all of it. Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates have been bombing it for the last 8 years and have had no impact on Houthi control whatsoever, and nor will the odd bombing raid led by a US coalition backed by New Zealand. I mean, why not deal with their core issue, which is what's happening in Gaza? You know, the Houthis won't be blocking straits if the Gaza and Palestinian-Israeli issues are resolved. So I think we really need to be back to seeing New Zealand as a small country that's acting on the basis of international law and wanting peaceful conflict to resolution to conflict rather than, you know, being the, you know, like some kind of, you know, Prussians of the Pacific rushing in wherever we see a fight.
So when you were Prime Minister, you focused a lot of attention on the Pacific and on New Zealand's independent foreign policy, and you hoped that would be bipartisan and based on New Zealand's distinctive national identity and so forth. Given our sort of now continuing expanding security entanglement with Australia and the US and Asian allies and even NATO, what does an independent foreign policy look like in 2024? Can you point to things that you did as Prime Minister where you asserted our independence, even with these entanglements?
Well, the only sort of active formal alliance we have is with Australia under the closer defence relationship, but that really doesn't take us past, you know, the Australia-New Zealand framing, in my opinion. I mean, New Zealand's independent foreign policy has been asserted in a number of ways, obviously in the decision not to have a bar of the invasion of Iraq, which is one of the most sensible things we ever did. And, you know, going back to, you know, the nuclear weapons-free zone here, support for in the Pacific and more widely, this is all important. I think if we were looking for, you know, new ways to play a role, we should re-energize our work on nuclear disarmament. I think we could also look at other areas which are not sufficiently governed in the arms area. For example, the biological weapons treaty is quite weak, and definitely in, you know, what we now fear around weakness of biosecurity regulation, etc. That could do with strengthening. There's areas of warfare around the use of artificial intelligence, drones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which are just ungoverned. And I think, you know, New Zealand could make a mark as a country interested in trying to, you know, reconstruct an effective weapons control infrastructure. Let's also not acknowledge that some of the weapons control infrastructure, for example, in Europe, has been dismantled by the Trump-Putin era and continues to be under huge strain. So I would like to see us, you know, really step up more in this area, and I don't see why that couldn't be a bipartisan endeavour.
In that regard, why do you think that the New Zealand peace movement is so relatively quiescent at the moment, as are the peace movements all around the world? I mean, we were shocked into action in the 70s and 80s, but you know, it seems to me that without some sort of civil society impetus, that focus on weapons of mass destruction and so forth will remain in the balance.
So if you go back to the 70s and 80s, when the Cold War was at its height, I think there was quite a widespread awareness in New Zealand that while we were very unlikely to be the target of a nuclear weapon, nonetheless, if the Northern Hemisphere wiped itself out, life would change for us very significantly. No getting on the plane to London or Los Angeles. Who are you going to sell to? Everything changed. And so you saw that incredible movement of the neighbourhood peace groups that sprung up across New Zealand when I became the MP for Mount Albert. The Mount Albert, nuclear-free community group. I mean, this was just one of, I'd say, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, across New Zealand. And so when, that Cold War came to an end for a brief period, maybe the movement hung up its boots a bit. Thought the job had been done, but it's not done. It's not done at all. I mean, we're seeing nuclear weapon use threatened. Absolutely. In the Ukraine war conflict. And then, with these other devastating conflicts like Israel, Gaza, Sudan, Myanmar, etc., I think with the pandemic, New Zealand looked very inward. We were locked down, we were preoccupied with our own issues. And now, people are Since then, people have been pretty down to it with the cost of living crisis, and now, what's going on politically here, which, in a way, sees the government, assaulting just about every social sector except the wealthiest. So, people are kind of down to it, and to ask them to look outwards again, it's not an easy ask in the context. But I think that those who care about it have to keep raising the issues and saying, New Zealand's reputation's on the line here as a small country that has stood for, more peaceful conflict resolution and a nuclear-free world and so on and so forth.
And finally, we've got only a few minutes to go. We can't stop without considering the whole question of climate change. Since 2023 was the hottest year for 174 years, the 22nd of July this year was the world's warmest day in recorded history. Antarctic and Arctic winters are warming. The 1.5% limit certainly will be exceeded. The Stockholm Resilience Centre concluded that 6 of its 9 planetary boundaries have been breached in terms of levels of pollution of air, soil, sea, and fresh water and loss of biodiversity. What do you think about the current government's position in relation to the environment? The Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade have said that, if they persist in dismantling a lot of our environmental regulations, that's going to pose huge reputational damage to New Zealand. What would you do if you were in Luxon's seat?
Well, I think it's very unfortunate that they are dismantling some of the architecture which was put in place before, and I think I think James Shaw did a terrific job as the climate minister in the government led by Jacinda and then by Chris Hipkins. It took a long time to get the Climate Change Commission in place, but the idea was to try and get a broad consensus about how we'd move forward. But it's not enough just to have a consensus around that architecture. You have to then put flesh on the bones. And, our farming community does have some issues to address. A fossil fuel-based power future is not where we want to be. If any country can be fully renewable, it's New Zealand. We're in a good rain year, we're, 80% renewable now. Lake Onslow pumped hydro would have helped secure that future as well. And that's gone down the proverbial drain. So I think it's going to be very problematic what happens with greenhouse gas emissions here now. We're not on a trajectory to meet any sensible target. And I think it will also be quite damaging for New Zealand and the South Pacific, because I can say, having sat at 9 Pacific Island Forum leaders meetings, 8 of them with John Howard as Australian Prime Minister, We were never the target of anger, he was. Kevin Rudd came along and climate was a priority for him and that changed. But now, you know, New Zealand will be seen as not acting on what is seen by the Pacific as an existential threat, which is climate change. And they want to see their major metropolitan partners, Australia and New Zealand, acting on this. You know, needless to say, when the climate change conference comes around this year, which it will in yet another petrodollar state, no doubt New Zealand will also get Fossil of the Water, of the Day Award, as we did last year, for what's not happening on climate action. So, A, we're not pulling our weight. Last time I looked, New Zealand had, what, about the fifth highest level of emissions in the OECD, which is not good. And we're quite, you know, per capita, we're quite significant globally. So our reputation is not what it could be.
This is the time to end. And before I do so, I want to thank you, Helen, for your wisdom and sharing your experiences with it. And since this meeting has been organized by SGI, I want to finish with a quote from your president, Daisaku Ikeda, who said, "Hope transforms pessimism into optimism. Hope is invincible. Hope changes everything. It changes winter into summer, darkness into dawn, descent into ascent, barrenness into creativity, agony into joy. Hope is the sun, its light, its passion. It's the fundamental force for life's blossoming. And when we change, the world changes. The key to all change is in our inner transformation, a change of our hearts and minds. This is human revolution. We have all the power to change. When we realize this truth, we can bring forth that power anywhere, anytime, and in any situation." So the onus is on you and me and all of us and to begin from where we are in order to transform ourselves and to begin that terrible transformation of the entire world. And I want to thank you personally, Helen, for your work and commitment on all of these peace, justice, sustainability issues over the years. You've been a sterling example to all of us, and I'm pleased to have counted you a friend for 15 years. 50 years.
And that segues very nicely into a question for each of you before we go to the floor, because we have talked about optimism, and you also mentioned almost in the same breath at the beginning, Helen, about the diminishing civic power. So my question for Kevin, which you can think about while you answer your question, Helen, my question for Kevin is, what can ordinary people without decision-making power do in intangible ways to contribute to building a more peaceful world? While you're thinking about that, I am going to go off script again because I need to ask this as a woman MP, and I know that Helen has an interest in this. We have seen throughout many of these conflicts a disproportionate impact on women and the disempowering of women very deliberately, which our Iranian solidarity friends have actually described as gender apartheid. How significant is that in your view, Helen, and what is that doing to create this polarisation that the world is experiencing? So I'll start with you first and then I'll go to Kevin.
I think one of the things we need to do is to make sure that we do not succumb to pessimism and to gloom and to despondency, to acknowledge that, you know, we do have capacity and power and has been demonstrated in the past. I mean, as Helen's already mentioned in relation to the anti-nuclear movement, I mean, people were gathering in homes all around the country and local government arenas and things. And so if we have clear objectives, it seems to me there's absolutely no reason why we can't kind of build new coalitions. The challenge is that, you know, the internet and our devices and everything are generating a passive audience to everything. We are bystanders that are watching what's happening before our eyes. And we have to move out of that frame of mind in order to become focused on how we can become proactive, less paralyzed human beings in a world which is intent on paralyzing us. And so it seems to me that that's, you know, we haven't discussed the media, but the media is a narcotic. I mean, forget religion being the opium of the people. I mean, the media is tranquilizing all of us, I think, to some extent, to just, you know, share the perspectives that are given to us rather than have us create new orientations, new perspectives, and new visions.
Thank you. And your question, Helen.
Yes, I mean, we definitely need more women leaders in the world, which is not to say that every woman leader is an angel either. Definitely not every woman leader is an angel of peace, but by and large, you know, I think women leaders are more inclined to be looking for a way forward that's based on dialogue and, you know, bringing people together than splitting them apart. This leads me to say something on the Women, Peace and Security agenda, also a Security Council resolution of, I think, close to 25 years ago now.
Yeah, 1325, yeah.
Yeah, 1325. And I did go to two events on this in New York in the last couple of weeks, talking about what's been achieved and what hasn't. And, you know, the reality is, whenever you look at some sort of talks between parties in conflict, how often are you seeing women on the front row?
Yeah.
You're not. You're not seeing them there at all. And I did observe at both of the events I spoke at that it is deplorable that the UN brought together special envoys on Afghanistan together with the Taliban in Doha in June and did not require that Afghan women were present. So if it's not upholding its own resolutions, how can it expect anyone else to? You know, this is not on. I mean, the most severe gender apartheid in the world is practiced in Afghanistan, as we see on a daily basis. I think you also mentioned Iran, Ingrid, and I've retweeted again this morning about the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, a woman in Iran, who's Narges Mohammed, I think, who's been detained unjustly as a political prisoner, denied access to proper medical treatment, obviously badly treated. I mean, if this can happen to a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, how can I imagine what's happening to those who have no profile at all? So there's a lot to be done on the women, peace and security agenda, and you know, defending those women and men who are human rights defenders who are brave enough to stand up and lead.
Thank you. We'll go to some questions from the floor. Have we got a roving microphone? We do. So if you can just put your hand up, we'll take one in the front row here. And if you can just say your name and or organisation as you preface your question, just in the front row over here. Thank you. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind standing up.
Kia ora, thank you very much. My name's Liz Rem as well. I'm from Te Mata o Māori, Hawke's Bay. And I'm Vice President of World Beyond War. And wonderful presentation, thank you so much. My question is around fear and security. And if we have been sort of trained to think that the bosom of the United States is going to take care of us, and we're under pressure from NATO to increase our military spending to 2%, I think we're up about 1.5% at the moment, and which is actually greater than the total of Ministry of Police, Justice, or Rangatamariki, and Conservation. How do we actually get our people to pressure the government to put our spending towards the things that really we need, like climate change, infrastructure, health, education, Te Reo Māori, etc.? Thank you.
Thank you. Helen.
Well, first question to ask is, what would this money be spent on? You know, what is so important that you increase to 2% when you can't fund your hospitals, your schools, your disability benefits, and numerous other things? When you look at AUKUS Pillar 2 and what it's, quote, exploring, is access to hypersonic weapons,
yes,
artificial intelligence and warfare, offensive cyber capacities? I mean, really? Against who? And we all know who it's aimed at. I reflect on, you know, the difference in tone from my years as PM, where in the Asia-Pacific, APEC was probably at its height. You had quite a good dialogue across the Pacific between China and the US. With respect to China and New Zealand, it was seen as opportunity. We registered differences where we had them. But there was a lot that you could you know, get on and do. And now we're being told to suddenly fear those who are part of, you know, ensuring our prosperity. So something has gone radically wrong. I think it's also important to recognise that even when the ANZUS Treaty was operational, and you've, you know, got to go back to the mid-1980s and the Muldoon era for that, it never had a binding security commitment from the United States, right? It was, all it provided was for consultation in the event of a threat. Well, that ain't a binding security guarantee. You know, no one's coming to save New Zealand. But who exactly is threatening us? Who exactly is threatening us? I think we just have to overcome the fear, as we did when, you know, operationally we were rejected from ANZUS and it faded from the public consciousness until revived in a ministerial statement in February out of AusNZ ministers' meetings, that we can make our own luck. We don't have enemies here. And we should be a voice for a different sort of world, not for buying into the fear about our security.
Well, and my comment on that would be that, you know, there's far too much negative othering in our political system at the moment. Mm. You know, we're not acknowledging each other's, you know, individuality, humanity, and so forth. And I think that negative othering is resulting in the deeper polarization, but it also makes us very susceptible to, you know, to kind of fearful comments by our political leaders. But the politics of fear is also very paralyzing. I mean, you know, we will only be able to be self-actualized individuals in a self-actualized nation if we transcend that and say, you know, we have capacity here to deal with all of the challenges that are likely to come our way.
So what I'm hearing on that, in the words of David Longy, is we need to stop and have a cup of tea. Yes. any other questions? Yes, we have one here.
Kia ora. My name is Somya. I am from the SJNZ. I'm one of the youth representatives there, and I have a... firstly, thank you so much for a great dialogue where I've learned a lot and really expanded my awareness on the various different dynamics, and it's definitely feeling very, very turbulent out there. My question is more at the grassroots level and inspired from today's theme with a small twist. From the perspective of a young man or a young woman in Aotearoa, New Zealand, how could we create peace in these turbulent times so that it ripple out as waves of peace into the rest of the world? Thank you.
Well, you might start by thinking about it at home and what's happening to us as a society as, you know, the politics of division bites. I mean, you know, you'd have to be completely insensitive not to see the threat that Māoridom feels under at the moment. You know, there's an assault on many levels to try to divide people. There's a, you know, that kind of division that comes when you begin to attack people who need the support of the state for whatever reason. You know, hard on their luck. You know? Who was it who said that, you know, society will be judged by the way it treats its old, its young, its sick, and its poor? Would we want to be judged right now? Or are we, you know, leaving people behind, swathes of people behind? So peace starts with, I think, a commitment to building a socially cohesive society where everybody, regardless of who they are, what their background is, their ethnicity, indigeneity, religion, faith, that they feel they are part of this country, and that being a New Zealander means you embrace that diversity and you listen to each other and you have a tolerance of and respect for each other. If you can stand tall like that as a society, you've got a chance of going out to the world and saying, you know, we stand for something better than what we see out here. You know, we need people to come together and reconcile their differences. And here's what we're trying to do. And in a way, we've been able to do that in the past. We've been able to say, we've got processes going here. Those processes are under a lot of strain.
Yeah. And I don't think we should be afraid of declaring that the welfare state actually was probably one of the best inventions ever devised by human beings, and to have it eroded and undermined and challenged as is happening at the moment, I think is a scandal. So I mean, you know, so the welfare state was womb to tomb security. It may have had its downsides. There may have been accusations of being a nanny state, but people were fed, unemployment was low, everybody had access to education and health. The Ministry of Works was able to get on with the job of building hospitals, and the electricity department made sure that nobody had electrical failures. I mean, so there's no reason why we can't in New Zealand say let's revive a kind of a welfare state for the 21st century in which everybody has a place. And everybody is able to realise their full potentiality.
I felt myself wince when you said hospital, being from Dunedin, and I saw Rachel Boyack from Nelson wincing as well. Do we have one final question before we go to our closing? Yes.
My name is Apurva. I'm a member of SGINZ, and I've also had the privilege of studying under Kevin at the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies. So nice to see you again. Helen, you mentioned that the power of the United Nations is diminishing. And I just wondered, as a member of the elders, how can we actually foster capable successors? How do we foster the next generation of peace negotiators? There isn't a lot of money in the peacemaking business, as we know, but how do we actually encourage next generation to take up that mantle of peace? Thank you.
Well, the world needs better leaders, doesn't it? Sort of across the board. I mean, it's a pretty dismal pick at the moment, by and large, with few obvious exceptions. And so I really go back to where I began, that you know, we have to have hope that coming out of civil society there will be pressures for something different. Civil society leadership has never mattered more, particularly when it's lacking at the national level. And while I think Kevin had a bit of a clip, and rightly so, at media in its different forms, social media can be a tremendous power for good and for connecting good ideas. And the world's nascent peace builders and people interested in these kinds of issues need to be getting together and, you know, sort of strategizing on ways forward. And you know, the centres like the one that Kevin was the founding director of need to be encouraged for what they can do to open young New Zealanders' eyes to the possibility for being a positive force for peace and diplomacy. Whether the economics of our universities allow for these sort of things these days, heaven knows, but it's very, very badly needed. But all I can do is, you know, encourage the great organisations out there that are interested in peace and dialogue. I see Karen Dickey and others here from the UN Association. Good on you. And we can't give up on the multilateral institutions. It's all we've got, right? Yeah. And they still manage to convene. You know, the Pact for the Future mightn't be much, but you know, a lot of leaders converge on New York. It is a place where people at least can exchange views. There is a strong body of international law, more on it than the breach and the observance, but you know, the normative framework is there. The institutions are there, and it's a question of how we can build fresh life into them, breathe fresh life into them to make them more effective going forward.
Also, I think that the other thing that we have to be aware about, in addition to kind of defending and promoting the welfare state for the 21st century, we have to really begin engaging the whole question of preserving and protecting democracy. Democracy is under huge threat all around the world at the moment. 74% of the world's populations live under autocracies, either elected or taken. And so, you know, the whole democratic project is in a minority position at the moment, which I think is really dangerous in terms of civil society, in terms of cohesive systems, in terms of right relationships between states and peoples. And so it seems to me that, you know, we really need to kind of, you know, ask ourselves, are our democratic institutions functioning properly? What do we need to do about them, and how do we defend them? And how do we make sure we have civil society actors and organizations who are able to hold our leaders to account?